Welcome back to Balagan. The different groups collaborating in the backlash against the judicial overhaul seem to have different leaders, pulling in different directions. While some say it should focus on the judicial overhaul only, other groups target some of Israel's deeper issues, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the tension between ultra-Orthodox society and the secular, and the settlers. Is this the way to stop the judicial overhaul? To discuss how to gain the most out of the protest movement, I'm glad to host Rachel Azaria, former member of the Knesset of Kulanu Party and author of Guided Revolution, that I gotta say, in Hebrew it sounds better, Hamadricha Lamaapecha. Welcome, Rachel, to Balagan.
Hi, Kobi.
So, Rachel, let's start with your background, because you are a long-term and professional social activist. You have a track record of social activism in Israel, so please share with us your background.
I've been in social activism since I was a student at Hebrew University, over 20 years of social activism. I started at Green Corps, Students for the Environment. Later, I ran an organization just before my 27th birthday. I ran an organization for Agunot, women that can't get their Jewish divorce. Later on, when a lot of my friends started leaving Jerusalem, I founded, together with some friends, I initiated founding a list for city council, Yerushalmi. I was a city councilwoman for 5 years. During those years, I was very active in social change. Those were very dramatic years in Jerusalem. We went back and forth to the Supreme Court against segregation and disappearance of women from public sphere. Was when they wouldn't put my poster on the bus, and then buses the women had to sit in the back of the bus in separate streets, and a lot of activism in those areas, and also on issues that have to do with pluralism and liberal ideas in Jerusalem, opening places for young families on Shabbat, the right for women to go to the mikveh, to the ritual bath, the way they believe it. It's part of Orthodox feminism. I'm Orthodox feminist. I've been that for many years already. A lot of activism related to young families. I was a mother of two when I started the term. At the end of the term, I was a mother of four. We were very active on these issues. It was just the very beginning when people realized that the government and the municipality have to put focus on these issues. Later on, I was, there were again elections. I was appointed deputy mayor of Jerusalem. As deputy mayor of Jerusalem, I worked a lot on the issue of healthy food in the school system and issues that are related to Orthodox feminism and feminism altogether, streets, names of women and names of streets in Jerusalem, many other issues. I was responsible for the education system in Jerusalem. Later, I continued to the Knesset, to the Israeli parliament. I was for one term, when terms were still 4 years, 2015 to 2019. And in those years, I continued a lot of my campaigns for young families. And since I was in a very Orthodox right-wing coalition, I found myself the more liberal voice in the coalition and a lot of campaigns against legislations that would really ruin a lot of our achievements in Jerusalem regarding, I was saying, women's issues, Orthodox women's issues, and also kashrut, the alternative kosher
certification.
So, and then towards the end of the term, I started realizing that we're going to have a challenge in our democracy and the challenge in Israeli society. I know that today it's obvious, but in 2019, when I was talking about it, I sounded very, people didn't understand what I was talking about. I wrote a book called Guided Revolution, Hamadricha Lamaapecha. The reason I wrote the book is because I realized that the reason I was willing to go out there and be like a guard of Israeli democracy during the term in the Knesset and the parliament, when Ayelet Shaked was trying to pass all these legislations that will narrow down the power of the Supreme Court. The reason I was very, very stubborn about it, and I didn't let these legislation pass, almost all the legislations we're talking about today, also in those years, they tried to pass it. And the reason I was very serious about it is because that I saw the power that we had when we went to the Supreme Court, that I knew what it means to live in a real democracy. I think that one of the challenges is that in Israel, till the last half year, people took for granted the fact that we live in democracy. And it was just like the air that we breathe. And people didn't realize that this is something, that democracy is something that you need to, as a concept, is a great idea that you need to guard, and you need to work very hard to make sure that you can enjoy democracy. And I think that the other challenge was that people didn't realize how amazing it is to live in democracy. Because if you don't, if you're not a social activist, so you don't really practice your democracy. And as in the book Roots for Radicals by Saul Alinsky, he talks about the fact that democracy is like the heartbeat. Sorry, that social change is the heartbeat of democracy. And in Israel, people weren't practicing this heartbeat. And actually, my book, Guided Revolution, is the first book on how to make social change in Israel. I hope it will become kind of the Saul Alinsky Rules for Radicals, because that's the only book that we have at this point. It sold well and it is being effective. And the other thing I did was to put together a group of people that will try thinking differently about the challenge between Judaism and democracy. Natan Sharansky, Yuli Tamir, Lekim Rubinstein, Professor Halbertal, Professor Nisim Mizrahi, Professor Nisim Leon, Dan Meridor, Benny Begin, Dr. Yafa Gisser. We sat for half a year trying to think differently about these challenges. And that's how the big project that I'm working on, Democracy Renewal, that's how it came out. And that's what I'm working on. And then this whole campaign broke. I mean, the coalition was formed and we realized...
The current coalition.
Current coalition, yeah. We realized what they're up to and what they're going to do. And I'm very active in the campaign in Israel against the judicial overhaul. Actually, we were out there very, very early. Yariv Levin, his very well-known speech was on my birthday. And I cried all night and it was terrifying because I foresaw this. And that moment that you see that your nightmare is happening is a very frightening moment. But actually the next day was much better because suddenly everyone understood. And the moment that a lot of people are worried about it, you know that you can take off your shoulders some of the burden. So that's in short.
First thing, it's really impressive. And especially when you're saying that you also have four creeds that you're going, it's like multitasking at its extreme, I would say.
Yeah, no, when I wrote my book, you know, I think that when you believe in something and you work on it, so it's very enthusiastic. And I didn't realize, like only when I wrote my book, did I realize how crazy it was what I was doing. I remember the moment that I was going through Google to remember when I did everything, like what were the dates? And we had this big, like we launched the idea of an alternative kosher certificate and we did it in a party on Friday. It was, instead of holding a demonstration, we wanted to do something more fun. So we did this party that was half demonstrative and I looked at the date and I remember that my son was very young. When I looked at the date, I realized he was 10 days old. Now, I remember the moment that, you know, I had to climb this ladder to give a speech. And I remember looking at the ladder and wondering if my knees are steady enough to climb the ladder. But I didn't remember how young Yona, my son, was. And I think that when you're really into something you believe in, so you have powers that you don't know you have. So that's it.
You did a lot, and you are also a member of the Knesset. You are a council member in Jerusalem. And one of the things that come up from your book is the role of the Supreme Court in Israel. Now, what we hear from the people who are supporting this judicial reform, as they call it, is that the Supreme Court took too much power into his hands, and they are bringing actually balance between the executive and the legislative branch to the Supreme Court. So tell me first thing, where does it find you? As a former member of the Knesset, it's somebody who also, some of your achievements actually came through the Supreme Court.
I think that the big story that we're not discussing is first of all, the fact that the power was taken away from the parliament over a decade ago. Basically, the government took the power from the parliament. And the way they did it is in a very sophisticated way. The idea in the parliament is that in Israel, I'll just say we don't have two House of Representatives, we have one. And the government is formed by the majority in the House of Representatives. So our legislations, the votes are in the parliament when always more than 50% of the members of the parliament are from the coalition that forms the government. So in the past, if an MK, a member of the Knesset, an MP, an MK, wanted to pass legislation, they had to convince enough members of the parliament to vote yay to pass the legislation. What happened over a decade ago is it started and it got stronger and stronger, is that every legislation gets a recommendation from the government. Okay. Now, in the past, there'd be a recommendation from the government. Not everything would get, but if it would get a recommendation, it was still a recommendation. And then still, if you are a member of the parliament, you convinced other members of parliament to vote with you. What happened was that they decided that every recommendation of the committee of the government regarding every legislation, it forces the members of the coalition to vote exactly what the committee of the government decided. So if I want to pass legislation regarding vacation days for parents, okay, if the government decides that I can't, so all of the coalition will vote against, even if 90% of the coalition agree with me. So this takes away a lot of the power. So what are the members of the parliament? We're basically doing what the government decides that we need to do. So instead of going and convincing your colleague MKs, you need to convince just a few ministers. So it means that the power of the parliament was transformed already to the government. And there are no real checks and balances between the government and the parliament. Now, if you dare to vote against what the government decided, you're allowed to legally. But if you do it, you'll get punished. I did it a couple of times for certain. And then they didn't let me pass legislations. They narrowed down my power in committees, a lot of punishments. So it's not that you do what you believe in or you can discuss in your party. It's basically the government forcing you to vote what they want you to vote. So what's happened over the past 10, 20 years is that the power from the parliament was moved to the power to the government. And the only institution that really has power that can give checks and balances to the government is the Supreme Court. Now, this made a lot of clashes through the years, because basically the government is often pretty homogeneous. And then the Supreme Court says, you know, okay, but what you want to do, you can't really do. And especially when you talk about issues that have to do with state and religion, because in the coalition for many, many years, almost since 1977, with a couple of breaks along the way, almost always the ultra-Orthodox are members of the coalition. And the ultra-Orthodox, the way they work is they say, we don't care about almost all the issues that are important to Israeli society, economy, security. What's important to us is our community and some of state and religious issues. And then they come into the coalition and they say, we'll give you everything you want, okay? But you give us what we demand, A, B, C, D, E, F, okay?
Which is the control over everything that's related to state and religious in Israel, technically.
But even that, just think about the issue of the ultra-Orthodox joining the army, okay? 90% of the Israelis, 80% of the Israelis, okay, think that the ultra-Orthodox need to join the army, okay? The government, which is the majority, has to give the minority and the government, the ultra-Orthodox, they demand that none of this will happen. They also demand that there won't be public transportation on Shabbat. They also demand a lot of issues that have to do with state and religion. And then the coalition forces the parliament to vote what the ultra-Orthodox want, what a small segment of Israeli society wants. So then the people that give the checks and balances are the Supreme Court. They say, wait, hold on. This is not what the majority of Israelis want. This is what 15% of the Israelis want. This is the kind of discussion that's happening. And then the coalition says, wait, hold on, we have the majority. And the Supreme Court says, wait, it's often issues against minorities and often just issues that don't make sense. You can't say that we're a country that promotes equality and then be so unequal on such certain issues just because that you need this 10% of Israeli society for forming your coalition. And then the coalition doesn't leave any leeway for the parliament. So I think that if we want to discuss this issue, and it's a serious issue of how we establish checks and balances, there is a major issue that everyone forgets, because at the end of the day, I don't think it's about checks and balances. I think the government wants to have a lot of power. And I'll just say that that's how politicians work. I was a politician for 11 years. It's really annoying when you come with something and you can't execute it because someone tells you no. So politicians always want more power. That's the way it goes. But we always need to make sure that the power isn't absolute, because when the power is absolute, it is very dangerous. And that's what this government wants to push towards. More power for the government, much less power already for the parliament that already happened, now also to the Supreme Court.
So technically, at the moment, we have three parts to this game. We have the coalition on one hand. We have the opposition that, I must say, from somebody who's observing from the outside, it seems that they hardly exist. And then you have the people on the streets, the protesters themselves, who are talking and bringing much louder voice against the judicial overhaul. From your experience in different campaigns, in order for the judicial overhaul to fail or for the campaign to succeed, what needs to work? What are the missing parts here?
First of all, I think that the campaign is pretty successful.
The campaign itself is successful, but eventually the coalition is the one making the decisions. So they can continue. In theory, they have 64 votes. They can do whatever they want if they want to.
Yeah, but we see that it's much harder than they expected. This is like, their idea was shock and awe. They thought that right after the elections, the liberal votes in Israel will be so overwhelmed that they'll just pass the legislation in no time. In fact, when I started working on this campaign, and we were very early out there, everyone told me there's no point. Till you get the troops together, till you get people together, all the legislations will pass already. And I told them, listen, you know, you can't do that. You have to go out and campaign on these issues. They're very important issues. It's truly one of the rare moments that it's not about right wing, left wing, not about modern Orthodox, secular, Masorti. It's not about Ashkenazi, Mizrahi. It's a real story of our democracy. And a lot of people understand that. So I think that was a very, very clear moment that something changed in Israeli society and the understanding that we have to be very active on this issue. And I think that we're pretty successful. I think they thought it would be much easier. No one expected, not what's happening with the soldiers, not what's happening in the economy, not the amount of people that are out there demonstrating again and again and again and again. Saturday night, very, very impressive. They were very, very hot days. And in the hot days, the protests kept going on. And people are really huge donations, very generous people. People are really out there. People stopped their lives to fight for Israeli democracy. And this is the first time in many years, I think, that the liberal crowd in Israel feel that they have a real purpose, feel that they're part of a community, that they're out there to fight what they believe in. Everyone, especially in a country that's so challenging like Israel, you really need to know why. Like, the why is very important. And it's a moment that people found the why. And I think that's one of the reasons that we're being successful. I think that we need to, first of all, the local elections are coming up.
Yeah, for the municipalities on October 31st.
And they're going to be very crucial moments for the liberal crowd in Israel. I think we're going to see major changes. The liberal crowd usually doesn't vote in local elections, like barely votes. The gap between the number of votes amongst the liberal crowd, like except for ultra-Orthodox or those areas, people usually voted 20% or 30% or 40% less than the national government, national elections. I think we're going to see major difference there. I think we're going to see a lot of changes. And I think these are moments that really everything is much more crystallized.
I mean, it's an amazing phenomenon. And we'll see on November 1st if the voting rates actually got higher. People actually don't understand it, that in many ways, and you experience from both being council member in Jerusalem and also a member of the Knesset, that eventually the municipality has a much bigger impact on their direct day-to-day lives. But that's actually a topic for another conversation that we may have in the future. But I want to ask you now, you know, you're talking about the impact of the protests. And in 2011, you were also a part of a different campaign that was for social justice, and it was more economic-wise, I would say, campaign. It was a huge campaign in Israel. People were sleeping in the streets in tents, and eventually it ended up with what was called the 500,000 demonstration, but then it faded out. What did the 2011 protest gained, what they didn't gain, and what do you think, you know, the people today need to learn from that protest?
So I think it gained a lot whenever it was clear to the protesters what they want. Okay. I was one of the leaders of the protests for young families. We came with a very clear program that we wanted the government to implement. Kindergartens for age 3 and 4, that they'll be for free, they'll be subsidized. After school activities will be subsidized. Tax benefits, change the tax benefits for young families, because till then the tax benefits were only for working mothers. And most mothers, when their children were young, didn't even hit the threshold to get the tax benefits. So we said, turn them into family tax benefits, that the fathers and the mothers or whoever, that the household enjoys it. And suddenly everyone enjoys the tax benefits. These were ideas that actually I worked on, some of them when I was city councilwoman, and I spoke to the committee several times. And so really, these were major issues. And I think that when we came with very clear demands, we were successful. And I think that the problem is that most of the demonstrations of 2011, they didn't have clear demands. What do you want? I think this time it's much easier. It is very clear, because this time it's not about demanding something, it's about stopping something. Yeah. And when you want to stop something, it's easier to say what you want exactly. So I think that that's one of the reasons that this campaign is more successful. And also I think this time people feel that it's now or never in many, many ways. So I think that's also a major part of the success of this campaign to compare to the 2011 campaign.
It's interesting the way you bring it up, because I agree with you. This campaign is actually, people are telling the government, you can change the rules of the games, yeah, of the game throughout the game. Like, yeah, you want to make changes? Let's talk about it after this game, or it can't be enacted for this coalition. And it seems that the current coalition is actually trying to grab as they go and to get as much as they can. But I want to ask you, we're talking about 2011. We had some meaningful campaigns in the past. And as you said, some of them were more successful, some of them were less successful. Some campaigns were less successful, even though they brought up really important issues. For example, if we look at the Black Panthers in 1972, who brought up the social injustice and the big gaps between periphery and the main of the land, and also between Ashkenazim and Sephardic in Israel, in the long run, it did change the conversation. And you can see that you have a lot more Sephardic people today that improved their lives. But on the other hand, it remained as a really big issue for political clashes. Some of the people who support the coalition are calling it Israel HaRishona neged Israel HaShnia, the first Israel versus second Israel, trying to revive things that not necessarily exist. So if I'm looking at it, and you're looking at the protest now, do you think that it will have any impact about those claims, you know, that it's Israel HaRishona against Israel HaShnia, first Israel against second Israel?
Yeah, I'll start with the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers were extremely successful. They eventually brought down the government, and that's how Begin was elected. It was also after the Yom Kippur War. But in Israel, major changes happen when it's not only one side of, in Israel, there's a very clear Rubicon, very clear gap, very clear rift between two segments of Israeli society. Right wing, which are usually also Mizrahim, more traditional people, left wing, which are usually more Ashkenazi, less traditional, more secular people, okay? And these two groups, whenever it's one group demonstrating, one group is pro something, the other one is against. So usually you're not successful in campaigns. But whenever you can have parts of the other group with you, that's when you win. So the Black Panthers, when they were just on their own, they didn't win. But once the Yom Kippur War came, and then there were more groups from Mapai, from the classic...
Yeah. Ashkenazi.
Ashkenazi, so-called left-wing, they're really left-wing, but whatever. I don't know if they're even more liberal, but whatever. That's how they...
Yeah, it was. It's 50 years ago. It's a bit different.
Yeah,
the terms have changed.
Yeah. When they became part of the protest and they were protesting against the government, that's when the government fell. My father made Aliyah from Tunis. My mother made Aliyah from the United States. German Jews escaped in the 30s, escaped Germany in the 30s. And I think that the relationship with the Mizrahi Ashkenazi in Israel, it's like there was a wound and it was stitched quickly, but there was some infection left in the wound that wasn't cleaned properly. And I think that what the Ashkenazi say is, what are you talking about? We stitched it a long time ago. Why are you talking about it? Now, it wasn't cleaned properly and it's still infected. So it still hurts every so often. And then you have the people that promote the idea of first Israel, second Israel, that they every so often put the fingers in the wound and everyone's like, oh my God, that hurts. Okay. And I think that what we need to do is acknowledge the fact that the wound is still infected, open the stitches, clean it off, even though it will be very painful. But that's the only way that we can let the wound heal, stitch it and let it heal properly. The wound isn't healed. So I think that what we're seeing now is a moment that these pains are really coming up in Israeli society. And I think it's a moment that we need to cherish. I think that, you asked at the beginning, do we need to talk about all the issues? Should we just stick to one, just the judicial overall? I think that what's happening is that Israeli society is trying to redefine itself. The way it works today, it can't work. We can't really have a growing percentage of Israeli citizens that just don't work. The fact that, the old Orthodox are now, 12%, maybe 30%. We can't really allow ourselves to have 15%, 16% of Israeli society that doesn't work, or works and barely works, or works and doesn't pay taxes. I mean, no country can afford that. And all of the money that the government invested in getting the ultra-Orthodox out to work, it is really billions of shekels. And the change is so minor. And I think this is a moment that everyone says, hold on, you know what? It was okay when you were small numbers. Now it doesn't work anymore. And also the decision about what does it mean to be an Israeli? Who we are and what we stand for. Okay, it can't be anymore just this coalition that figures it out. They just do what this group without. Doesn't work anymore. And I think there is a lot of work, and also our educational system and the gaps and the periphery and the center and the Mizrahi and the Ashkenazi. There are a lot of issues that we really need to define. And I think that that's what we're trying to do. Now, I'll tell you that, and I think that we'll try to wrap it up with this. I think that when you look at Israeli history, you realize that there's always, always a mission that seems impossible. And we always overcome it. So if we go through history, the 40s and 50s, mission impossible was to establish the state of Israel. No one thought we could do it. It was against all odds, but we did it. We did it. And really, amazing. Then
and
there
we
was
built an amazing infrastructure.
Amazing infrastructure. Amazing country. We were as poor as they come, but we did it, okay? And then you have the 60s and the 70s. The mission were the two big wars. And again, it was mission impossible. The weeks before the Six-Day War, everyone was sure the state of Israel is over. The first 48 hours of the Yom Kippur War, everyone was convinced it's the end of the state of Israel. But that generation, we did it. We overcame, we did it. And then you move on to the 80s and 90s. The 80s, the huge challenge was the economy. The stock market fell. We had the
inflation.
Crazy hyperinflation. You would go to buy something in the store in the morning and the evening and the price was different. At a certain point, the government couldn't talk in shekels anymore. They started talking in dollars, in U.S. dollars. And, you know, changed the lira to shekel and shekel to new shekel. And that's when Startup Nation started. That was the 90s, right after the hyperinflation. And that's where our macroeconomy was amazing and really was rebuilt against all odds. And then you go to 2000, 2010. And against all odds, the idea is, how do you distribute the goods to make sure that more people enjoy it? And that's the microeconomy. Remember, you talked about the demonstrations of 2011. It was about, how do we make sure that everyone enjoys the goods that we have in Israel? And that's the microeconomy. And when you look at it, it's very much like the pyramid of needs of Maslow. And the next stage in the pyramid is who you are and what we stand for. What is our identity as a country? And this is the challenge we're facing now. This is what's happening now in the streets. It's kind of some people call it a cold civil war. I want to call it a cultural civil war. It's a very, very precious moment that's going to take a long time. It won't be over. It's probably a decade or two, another generation. And at the end, we will really understand who we are and what we stand for. And when we look at American history, this moment is very similar to the American Civil War. The United States defined itself in the Constitution when the United States was born. But the moment that really defined what it means to be an American, what it means, the freedom in America, is the Gettysburg Address. And that was a very crystal moment. We don't have our Gettysburg Address. We don't even have a constitution. We have so much work that has to be done to make sure that we can really move on to this next stage in the pyramid of needs of Maslow. But I think that's the challenge that we have. And when things seem really impossible, very, very impossible, like some days here, I remind myself that if we could establish the state of Israel, not our forefathers, and if we could handle the Yom Kippur War, and if we could handle the fall of the stock market, if we could do all of that, also this challenge is possible. So it would be hard, would be painful. It's already hard. It's already painful, but I'm very certain that we'll come out much, much stronger out of this.
Rachel, I gotta say it was a great grand finale for the episode. I will say that also you mentioned Gettysburg and, you know, the Constitution. You also need those Lincolns. I'm sorry, I'm saying it in Israeli accent, people. Yeah, the Lincolns and the George Washingtons and actually the David Ben Gurion. So I think the next step is also to see the leadership that is uprising from what's happening.
I think it's still early to find them. Yeah, but I think that some of this leadership will be found.
Yeah, hopefully. Rachel, thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Kobi.
If you found this episode enlightening or thought-provoking, be sure to subscribe to Balagan on your favorite podcast platform so you never miss an episode. And hey, if you're feeling extra generous, leave me a review. Your feedback means the world to me and helps others to discover the show. Of course, sharing the episode link with others will also be greatly appreciated. Remember, the conversation doesn't have to stop here. Join me on Balagan's Facebook group to continue discussing today's episode and connect with fellow listeners. I would love to hear your thoughts, questions, and suggestions for future topics. You are more than welcome to check my website, www.balaganil.com, for additional resources. I'm committed to connecting you with Israel and providing you with proper context. Until the next time, remember that knowledge is power. Keep learning, keep growing, and continue engaging with Israel. I can't wait to catch you in the next episode of Balagan.